From UFOs to psychic powers and government conspiracies, history is riddled with unexplained events. You can turn back now or learn the stuff they don't want you to know. A production of iHeartRadio.
Hello, welcome back to the show. My name is Matt.
Our compatriot Noel is on adventures. They call me Ben. We're joined, as always, with our super producer, Paul Mission Control Deccant. Most importantly, you are you. You are here, and that makes this Stuff They Don't Want You to Know. This is a food episode, which means usually, you know, in the course of recording this, Matt, you and I are going to become increasingly famished, right?
Yes,
that's
for
what
certain
happens.
As you know, generally we don't eat a lot of things prior to recording for some reason. I don't know why we do that to ourselves, mostly because we're just working to get all the information, make sure we're ready to roll. But yeah, this one in particular could make you hungry. It's not gonna make you feel squeamish like maybe some of our other food episodes.
Right. And shout out to the listener on Twitter. I think I sent this to you guys. Shout out to the listener on Twitter who joined in our debate about calamari as pig holes, pig intestines, we should say. That conversation continues. This is not like that. Not today's episode, to your point, Matt. This is the first in a recurring series because recently, longtime listeners, you'll recall that we did a second part on the weird conspiracies around fast food or the food industry in general. And we got a lot of our fellow listeners wrote to us with their own takes on this. And several wrote to us asking about one big aspect of the food industry we did not explore, which is the livestock industry.
Yeah. The livestock industry is big and it's powerful when you think about all of the components, all the companies, all the interests that exist there, which means, I mean, like a lot of big things, it has secrets in how it got that big and what it has to do to continue on being big. So for the purposes of this episode, let's begin with how did the meat industry become so big? And with a lot of things, when they become big, you can lower prices because you're, you know, doing all kinds of things to make the process of producing whatever you're producing cheaper. So let's start this episode with why is meat so cheap, at least here in the United States?
Here are the facts. Well, hang on, you might be saying, hang on. Bag your badgers, gentlemen. Meat is not cheap.
I would have agreed with you.
Right. Many people would before diving into some of this stuff. So first, there are a couple factors at play here. Everyone who has survived the pandemic so far knows that temporary COVID-related closures of factories did drive prices up. And this was compounded by panic buying, right? Which is one thing when you are preparing for chaotic or unstable situations, you never want to be panic buying. You want to already have your stuff, you know, in your deep freezer and your pantry, et cetera. But people were scared. And so there was a smaller supply than normal for a little while, and there was a larger demand. So it drove some prices up. But really, meat in the U.S., if you are just the average, you know, John, Jane, or Jehoshaphat walking through your grocery store, meat in the U.S. is pretty cheap, especially when compared to many other countries. So to get a sense of how meat prices in the U.S. relate to the rest of the world, we have to take a global perspective, right? We have to look at the world's meat industry first.
So if we're looking at the price of meat across the world, there are a lot of different factors that go into a specific country's price of meat. So I think it's better for us to look at how affordable is meat in any given country across the world. So let's consider an absolute price, the price that you'd see wherever you procure your meat at a farmer's market or a store or something. That sticker price can be lower in one country, and it doesn't matter that it's lower overall because it may not be affordable compared to the income that an average person is able to make when you think about the amount of the percentage of income they'd be able to spend on food or meat. For example, there's this group called Caterwing, and there's a great article on Eater where you can see this information written out in graphs. They calculated how many hours a local resident of any given country would have to work at minimum wage to afford 2 pounds of any given meat type. So chicken, pork, whatever. And it's really interesting to think about it in that way. I think it's probably one of the closest things to a standard metric to really compare the prices of food and meat in particular across the world. So let's look at Indonesia. Their meat is super cheap. Super, super cheap. It's about 38% cheaper than the global average.
As of 2017.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. These stats are from 2017. We've also got some stuff from 2018 that we'll be mentioning in the show. A lot of times, you know this, it takes a while to get all of these aggregated numbers in, to crunch them all down, and then to present something like Eater did in their article, or like Caterwing did when they calculated this stuff. So according to 2017 prices, meat in Indonesia is among the least affordable in the world, even though it's 38% cheaper than the global average. And according to this index that Caterwing created, Indonesians have to work more than 23 hours to afford 2 pounds of beef. That seems like a lot. That's almost three times as much as people who live in Hong Kong have to pay or have to work in order to buy meat, and nine times as much as an American would have to work to afford 2 pounds of meat.
Yeah. So I think that's a good way to frame that conversation, because an ultimate price is a tricky thing. It's not the same thing as something being affordable. What I like about the work here is that you can slice it, not a pun, a number of different ways, because of course chicken is going to be cheaper than beef, right, in most countries. You can slice it this way. One thing I want to walk back on here is that this thing, which is called the Caterwing's Meat Index, doesn't include every country. It's the top meat-producing countries that have to work at minimum wage. And you can see some, I think the highest in this affordability index would be India, where people have to work 27.36 hours for 2 pounds of meat overall. And the thing about these kind of aggregations is that there are a lot of tricky things here. So your individual mileage may vary if you are a resident of one of these countries. But I really wanted to include that, because Americans eat a lot of meat, or U.S. residents, I should say, eat a lot of meat because it's easier for us to do so if you look at numbers like this. So I was talking about global overall look. The best way to do that is to look at production and consumption statistics. So, and I promise we're going somewhere with this. So here's the bottom line, conspiracy realist. Despite small variations year over year, meat consumption in general is increasing because the world is growing more wealthy. Global demand for meat is growing. Over the past 50 years, meat production has more than tripled, and now the world produces more than like 340 million tons, more than that easily every single year. There's a guy named David Sprinkle, who's a research director at Packaged Facts, and he has a quote about this that we quite enjoyed. It's the following: in many parts of the world, meat is among the least affordable food options. It's generally pricier than locally available grains, beans, vegetables, and fruit. However, as average incomes rise, more people eat meat, first as an occasional treat, and then finally as something they consume multiple times a week, if not daily. And if you have traveled, if you're not from the U.S. or if you've traveled outside of the U.S., depending on where you went, you'll notice that meat functions as a status symbol in some parts of the world. I mean, I've been in places where without getting too deep into it, I was a vegetarian for a while, and I was in situations where it would be offensive to refuse food that someone offered me that beyond just being a bad guest, it would be offensive because it contained meat. So it was very – it was like a somewhat prestigious thing, right? So I totally broke it. I didn't want to be that person saying, I know life is very challenging here, but I'm too good for what you cook. You know, there's a big cultural thing about consumption of meat here, and it plays into it because now it's kind of like there's something about success to it. It has the air of success. And this seems set to continue if we look at projected trends. The Packaged Facts Group has something called the Global Meat and Poultry Trends, and they expect, despite any disasters, man-made or biological, meat consumption is going to increase at least 1.4% through 2023. And again, a large part of this is due to the economic rise of some of the countries that you would hear called BRIC once upon a time. You know what I'm talking about there, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's astonishing to think that meat consumption would increase, 1.4% year over year for that long, given the challenges that the meat, the overall meat industry faces, especially countries like the U.S. that does produce a ton of meat and then exports a lot of meat as well. And just thinking about safety factors, we've heard stories of so many poultry and other meat factories having to close, or those factories continuing to function even when there was an outbreak of coronavirus within the factory on the factory floor, and then was kept quiet, which is something we will likely be talking about in the future. It's just astonishing to think something like that wouldn't put a big hole in that growth, or a damper on that growth. But as we talked about before, we eat as humans so much dang meat. Anyway, sorry, to get back to the BRIC countries, that's Brazil, Russia, India, China. Those countries, we've talked about them several times in the context of BRIC and why they're called that.
So we've set up a very high level look at the global situation. But if you are asking where's the beef, you have to ask about Uncle Sam. If we zoom in the Google Earth of your mind to the U.S. meat industry, and we do the same thing, look at production and consumption stats, then we quickly see cattle production is the most important agricultural industry in the United States, accounting for $66.2 billion in just cash receipts in 2019. And overall, this industry, cattle production specifically, represents about 18% of the $374 billion in total cash receipts that were forecast for all agricultural commodities in 2019. The big cow is real, and big cow is big, I guess, if we really want to simplify it. And in addition to, they're kind of in like a men's hair club, I'm not just the president, I'm a member kind of situation, because in addition to having the world's largest, what they call fed cattle industry, the U.S. is also the largest consumer of beef. This might not be true forever as these other countries are rising in their economic status. And so again, the thing that I really want to hit on is that difference you mentioned, Matt, between an ultimate sticker price and affordability. It's not just how big the slice is out of your budget. It's how big the overall pie, mincemeat pie, is. So how did we get here? Well, food used to be much more expensive. Actually, our spending on food in the U.S., as a slice of our meat lover's pizza, has actually declined dramatically since 1960. But even since before then, you can see charts from the Department of Agriculture that show, like, if you went from 1960 to 2007, you would see it dropped by almost half, from 17.5% of a household income to 9.6%. We're purchasing more food for less money, and we're using less of our income to do it.
Thanks, fast food.
Yeah.
Because a lot of that beef ends up in a burger from whatever fast food joint you go to.
Mm-hmm. And think about the increase in portion size in places. Think about the increase in dining out in places. Think about...
Dining in now,
pre-pandemic. So it's odd, isn't it, that with the price of so many things rising over time, the cost of some foodstuffs, meat in particular, seems to have actually declined in the U.S. over time. Why is this happening? Is this a thing that is going to continue in the future? And what does it mean? You know what I mean? What price are we actually paying for this? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor. Here's where it gets crazy.
Well, none of this happened by accident. It doesn't necessarily mean it was planned to go down exactly this way, but it wasn't an accident. It takes a lot of work to maintain all of the things that we've been talking about, specifically production and, you know, keeping consumption at levels is actually, oh, that's a marketing thing. We can talk about that later. There are a ton of often ignored side effects and consequences, real consequences, when it comes to eating this much meat and especially producing this much meat. And we actually may be paying more for meat, just not in, you know, the sticker price. We, the end user, consumer of meat, isn't the one necessarily paying for it with the dollars out of their wallet. We might be paying for it with our lives.
Well,
our future.
Here's the thing. We've got a lot of listeners in the crowd who are maybe themselves vegetarians. Maybe you're listening along and you're saying, well, I don't participate in this because I'm vegan or vegetarian. Well, if you pay taxes, you are supporting this industry. And we'll show you how momentarily. We've also got a ton of people listening today. A lot of us are listening maybe in a meatpacking plant. Maybe making food in the kitchen, you know, and breaking out some ribs you were excited about or something. Like I'm going to try to cook some ribs. I've always got a weird food project going on, but this is at every level of American society. And maybe it's when we're exploring how this came about and what it means, maybe it's best to propose a couple of factors and then see which one is the primary driver, or if they all work together. First, geography. It's crazy, you know, you don't know what you've got till it's gone, as Joni Mitchell said. I think that was Joni Mitchell, right? Yeah, as Joni Mitchell said. Big Yellow Taxi, good song, holds up. The U.S. has this tremendous abundance of natural resources. We have a lot of space. There's a lot going on between the East and West Coast. And you may not hear about it, but it's a very productive part of the world. It's easy to grow food pretty cheaply here, amber waves of grain and so on. But that alone can't be the entire answer, because there are other parts of the world that are, you know, that are so-called breadbaskets or that are hubs of a cattle industry. So what makes the U.S. a little bit different? I would say we have to consider four basic things: subsidies, lobbying, corruption, and security.
That makes a lot of sense, because most of the larger companies, even some small companies that are involved in any way in the meat business, including the big old meat packers, like I guess the Tysons of the world, they're represented by one or more of these powerful meat trades. You've probably heard of this. We've spoken about it a little bit before, but you know, you can think of these as lobbying organizations, essentially, groups that they exist entirely to prop up one or more meat product, like big pork, essentially. This kind of thing really exists. There's one called the American Meat Institute, or the National Meat Association, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association. These are powerful groups, and a lot of them have very strong voices in, you know, decision-making heads of Washington, because a lot of these groups essentially represent workers who are voters, and that's why it's there. That's mm-hmm. why it's so powerful.
Well, yeah. What do you want to be that congressperson who has to go back to your constituents and say, hey, I approved some new regulations that may be better for consumers, but they are going to be much more expensive for the companies that employ you. And that kind of stuff rolls downhill.
Yeah, it's a convoluted process, making sure meat is affordable enough to be consumed at levels that are high enough so that you have to continue producing. And so everybody has jobs and, you know, all like it's so complicated when you get into it. But these groups, these lobbying groups are making sure everything is functioning at least to the best that they can make it.
Right. Yeah. So think about salmonella scares, right? Think about Ebola scares, things like that. This is where some of these groups come into play. And they've been accused in the past of pressuring members of Congress to stifle or hold back regulatory moves. So they push against expensive safety standards and regulations, but they also work continually to keep meat appearing very inexpensive at your local store. There's a continued drive for efficiency. It's kind of weird, right, that chicken sells for less than $2 a pound. That's cheaper than peanuts in a lot of parts of the world. So There's another thing here, another entity that often gets painted as the villain, and that is government action, the factory farm lobby, you'll hear it called. The argument is they secure these huge handouts, and these handouts suppress the true cost of meat. So when we say handouts, we're not just talking about direct farm subsidies, which are a real thing, right? And they're an important thing economically. We're also talking about some indirect stuff, some things you might not be as aware of if you're outside of the industry. Like, has someone made too much chicken or too much mutton or beef or what have you? Well, there may be a buyback program for excess animal products. There may be programs that subsidize the promotion of meat. There may be loans that are subsidized over time on much more favorable terms than any loan you or I could ever get.
Yeah, it's not going to happen. And in the end, the U.S. spends around $38 billion every year to subsidize the food that is produced here. And that's all of it. So everything from peanuts to pigs. So $38 billion, and almost all of it goes to meat, or the vast majority of it goes to meat. Think about this, 0.04% of that $38 billion goes to subsidize fruits and vegetables. That's $17 million out of $38 billion that goes to fruits and vegetables.
Right. That's why you'll hear people sometimes argue that eating a meatless diet is more expensive than eating an omnivorous diet. That's not entirely true. It really depends on what you do with it. I have one friend who's a lifelong vegetarian associate and refers to himself as a French fry vegetarian because he is a very unhealthy person. So, and he will, you know, it's for him, it's rice, beans, and fries.
That's awesome. But also just think about this when we're talking about that $17 million for subsidizing fruits and vegetables. Think about the last time you visited, any grocery store or something. A lot of the produce that you're going to find, those fruits and vegetables, come from other countries. Mm-hmm. You know, from Chile, from just anywhere across
Mexico,
a lot of Latin America, a lot of South America. And, you know, that's one of the reasons that it's different there rather than subsidizing money, because you're talking about imports then.
Yeah, very good point, Matt. That is a very good point here. So that's not entirely our answer, though. If the government is doing this and the lobbies or the trade industries are working with the government hand in hand, that's something that happens at across a lot of industries. It happens in the tech industry, right? Maybe a more compelling explanation, maybe another piece of the puzzle, is that meat is cheap because it is so ruthlessly efficient to produce in a lot of ways. And this sounds absurd, right? At first blush, because All sorts of activists have talked about the inefficiency of animal agriculture and have raised very good points. Like, if you think about it, cattle grown for beef are – it's tremendously inefficient from a caloric intake perspective. A U.S. cow takes about 16,000 pounds of water for each pound of weight it gains. And, of course, you know, admittedly, cattle are very expensive part of this puzzle, but they're also a smaller piece when you consider what people are eating, because a lot of people are eating chicken because it is so, so cheap, right?
Yeah, that's correct. So let's take a look at broiler chickens. Like, it's a chicken to be eaten. And there are lots of companies that have been working out there for a long time to figure out how to make chickens bigger, how to make them grow faster, and really just increase efficiency all around when you're talking about a single chicken that then gets sold, it grown and sold. And right now, you only need 2.4 pounds of feed to produce a pound of usable chicken meat. Now, if you compare that to a cow, I mean, it's something insane, like like 24 kilograms of feed that are required to make a single unit of beef. It's crazy. But that makes a lot of sense. It's cheaper to get one chicken out there. And one chicken is a substantial amount of meat when you think about how large chickens are, especially in the United States when you're looking at these modified versions.
These Blade Runner chickens.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. It's absolutely nuts. Also, what are corn nuts? This has bothered me for a long time. Are they like puffed corn? Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's corn, right? It's hardened corn for your pleasure.
we've also got to do an episode on corn at some point, because it is odd for people outside of the U.S. to travel here and realize corn is in everything in one form or another, right? Corn syrup. When's the last time you ate something that didn't have corn syrup in it? When's the last day you went without encountering corn syrup?
When's the last day that I recognized that corn syrup was a part of whatever it was that I was eating? It's been a long time. It's been a long time.
We just sort of accepted it. You're right. It is ubiquitous. But it's often, you know, said that these subsidies are a huge part of what drives down the sticker price of meat. But there are also exceptions to regulations. So critics allege that if the U.S. government required some of these very large-scale operations to treat their waste appropriately, the way that municipalities are bound to do by law, then this would cost the industry an estimated $80 to $20 billion a year. Guess where that cost would end up being recouped? It would be you, if you buy meat. It would be carried on to the consumer. So that leads us to the question, how much should this stuff actually cost? We'll tell you after a word from our sponsor.
And we're back. Now, if you listen to the show often, you know that we cover the concept of hidden costs within any given action or industry. We've done it all the time, and those hidden costs exist everywhere in the meat production machine. According to one David Simon, this is the author of Meatonomics, not David Simon, the creator of The Wire and other things, right?
Different David Simons.
Okay.
Not everybody can, not one person could be that good at so many things.
Okay. So David Simon, he's the author of Meatonomics, and he has found, or he believes he has found, the answer to this question. These hidden costs are things that everyone collectively will be paying for in the long run, even though we have relatively affordable meat, especially in the United States. And he's looking at some pretty huge numbers here in hidden costs.
Yeah. So animal food producers, according to Simon, impose somewhere around $414 billion worth in hidden costs on American society every single year. To be completely transparent, before we see how he defines that, David Simon is a person who has a cause, right?
He has an agenda.
Yeah, he's partisan in this regard because he wants the same restrictions that have been applied to tobacco to one day be applied to meat. So he's definitely got a strong position here. Here's how he breaks it down. He says, when we think of hidden costs, we need to think of bills for healthcare, those subsidies, the environmental damage involved, and other items related to producing and consuming meat and dairy. Animal food production, from his perspective, now surpasses both the transportation industry and electricity generation as the greatest source of greenhouse gas. So if we put it, loaf of bread, jug of milk, Big Mac index, we can get a more concrete sense of this. According to him, if we included all the hidden expenses that the meat industry offloads onto society in the price of a single Big Mac, it wouldn't be $5 anymore. It would be $13, which means that every time a fast food place sells any kind of sandwich, in the Big Mac example, if they're selling a $5 Big Mac to you, you are at some point in some way paying another $8 in hidden cost. And it's easy to miss that.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. I would have to just point out that the meat production industry is the transportation industry. And when you think about how far the end product has to travel, how far all of the other, you know, goods have to travel in order to produce, God, it's weird to say produce and grow the cows, but to have a cow become alive and then live long enough and create enough mass for it to be a sellable product. There's all kinds of transportation costs involved there. Mm-hmm. But yeah, no, it's an interesting point that David Simon places there. If you imagine going out to eat or just buying food at the store, if you imagine your beef was another $8 for that food, I can't imagine being able to afford it.
Yeah, not every day.
Because we eat every day. Most of us, we try very hard to. But good God.
Well, yeah, and there's another aspect to this too. We see other countries taking a different tact, and often they're countries that import food, so it's already going to be more expensive. But they also levy tariffs on different things, right? So the other governments have tried to intervene in some way to address what they see as the hidden cost, right? But what I love about the fantastic point you make with the how did you say it? It was the meat industry is the transport industry. I think that's brilliant, especially if you look at just the way that chicken may be transported for processing across the Pacific. It may be grown here, sent to another country for processing, sent back here. Those chicken wings may have seen more of the world in a very horrible, unenjoyable way than we ever will. It's something that I think bears consideration. And at this point, I think what we've done is, you know, this is just part one of a series. We wanted to establish some of the hidden cost to the meat industry. But we need a disclaimer at the end. This is not some hit piece on farmers or some sort of propaganda about the benefits of being vegetarian. There are benefits to being vegetarian, but Matt and Mission Control and I are not vegetarian, so we're not going to criticize that lifestyle, but we're also going to be honest. We are omnivorous. But there's another thing about the livestock industry. It is mission critical for the U.S. economy right now. So many people do this. It's a job. It's a career. So you can't just turn off the faucet. It would be economically disastrous. Okay, and then there's the part about alternative meats, right? Have you ever had an Impossible Burger?
I have, yeah, and I very much enjoyed it. But it's not the same. And I don't know when it will be the same experience, the same joy that you get for some reason, because our childhoods were filled with, I think, 79 cents burgers or however much they were at the time. They were so cheap. Oh my God, they were cheap. But thankfully, across the world, there's all kinds of research and companies that are focusing on alternatives to meat, ways to get protein that we need, you know, for our human bodies to grow. But the problem is, it's not affordable right now. It's just not affordable. However, there are alternatives, you know, that would fall in the vegetarian category that can afford to, you know, it can give you the protein that you need that don't cost as much as meat, but it's not the same experience. It's not the same thing as having some kind of alternative meat.
Yeah, some kind of meat-like substitute. It's true, and it's not because those things are super fancy or super crazy expensive so much as it is that traditional meat is super, super absurdly cheap. That's the real hurdle there. And it's a strange system. You know, farmers are some of the hardest working people in this entire country. And you hear about those subsidies all the time, but a lot of farmers don't get those subsidies. They don't get the things you hear people complaining about. In the last 15 years, something like 2/3 of American farmers didn't get a penny from direct subsidies that were worth over $100 billion. Those funds mainly go to big corporations, and that subsidy money spurs the growth of these factory farms, which can be kind of bad for local economies because they employ fewer workers per animal than regular farms, and they buy most of their supplies outside of the local area, the local economy, or they have control over multiple related industries, right? Like, now I own the trucks, now I own the grain, now I own the cattle. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I'm reminded of our whole episode on farm subsidies.
Yes.
Where we talk about a lot of that. And I would recommend you listening to it if you have a chance and you're interested in that stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's the subsidies themselves become an industry, you know? And right now, 80% of this country's beef industry is controlled by just four companies: JBS, Smithfield, Cargill, and Tyson. They have been accused of price fixing numerous times throughout recent history in a way that doesn't benefit anybody on the beginning and end of the equation. The idea is they'll keep live cattle prices low and try to make beef prices higher, just a little bit at a time. And this is at the expense of the American farmer on one side, the American consumer on the other. And there's a lot of litigation about it, but it's one of those things that maybe isn't the sexiest headline.
But think about what that means. They're working to make sure the cattle are cheap. So when that farmer who has put in all the effort, you know, if it's not one of these giant companies and factory farms, even if it's a small farm that's been purchased by a giant company like a Tyson or Smithfield or something like that, just by having the end product that farmer creates, a cow that is ready for slaughter, and reducing it way down, it just means it's harder and harder for that farmer to make a profit in all of the massive expenses that are required to having and maintaining a farm. It's just, I don't know, man. It's weird to think that that's what they're doing to then keep it super cheap on the end user side. I don't know, but it makes sense. I mean, it makes sense. It's all about mass scale in those instances. Mm-hmm.
It's an economy of scale for sure. It also becomes a matter of sustainability. How long can this keep going? Especially as we hurtle toward a planet where people are more and more likely to be fighting over potable water, like on a large scale. Where are we going to get the water for this kind of industry in the future? And again, how cheap should it be? How many backroom deals happen between that cow out there grazing in a field and the hamburger that you've made or are eating? We have a lot more to cover in the secrets of the livestock industry. There are a couple of things, Matt, that you and I mentioned that are their own episodes. I would say corn probably counts in the livestock industry because so much of it is involved there. We're going to cover more of this in the future. In the meantime, we want to hear from you. Do you think that there is a way for meat prices to more accurately reflect these hidden costs we've described? Should they reflect those hidden costs? Would you buy them? I mean, I'm going to be honest. I love a good steak. I have no idea how much it should actually cost, but it probably shouldn't be the price it's at now.
Yeah, that's the big question that we want to ask you. If beef did cost what it should, could you afford it? Would you splurge on it for a special occasion or something, or would you just stop eating it altogether? We'd love to know how you would handle it. You can find us everywhere. We're on social media. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at Conspiracy Stuff. On Instagram, we are Conspiracy Stuff Show. If you don't want to do that, you should head on over to this thing we like to call Here's Where It Gets Crazy.
Right. That's our Facebook page where you can hang out with our favorite part of the show, your fellow listeners. If you don't care for Facebook, if that doesn't quite rustle your cattle, then you can call us directly, 1-833-STDWYTK. They're 3 minutes. They belong to you and no one else. Give us new ideas for topics you think your fellow conspiracy realist will enjoy. And or, you know, just tell us what's on your mind. Come with a cool nickname. It's up to you. It's really your 3 minutes. All that we ask is let us know if it's okay to use your name and or voice on the air. And if you don't particularly care for that mode of communication, there's one more way that you can always get in touch with us, regardless of the time, regardless of the place, regardless of the space. That is our good old-fashioned email address where we are.
Conspiracy@iHeartRadio.com. Stuff They Don't Want You to Know is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.